This is John Costa with Rob Watson recording Spotlight on Art. How are you this week, Rob? You okay?
I'm very well, thank you, John.
Good, good. So, good weather. We've said we're never going to mention the weather normally, but being as the weather's still nice, it's nice.
A bit warm. Every silver lining that we can get.
Absolutely. It will soon be Christmas.
And chill out and appreciate it while we can. Yeah.
Absolutely. And we're actually changing our venue again. We've had quite a few good times down here, actually, in the basement gallery at Adult Education with the Doc Photo 8 exhibition and various bits and pieces. So it's actually great to be down here. And this week on Spotlight on Art, we've got a very talented artist, creative, performer. Actually, I am going to ask you what you actually want to describe yourself, actually. So welcome, Miffy Ryan. How are you?
Oh, hello. I'm a bit hot and sweaty, mentioning the weather as well. Mm. I would describe myself as a single mum, live artist. Morning. Yeah. And philosopher.
And philosopher.
That's my dog, Milo.
Reacting to people walking past us while we're recording. Brilliant, brilliant. So just... You know, when was the first time you think that you can remember doing anything that you would consider creative now when you look back? Was it when you were younger? Was it like school? Was it sort of something that was out of education, informal? What do you think?
From as long as I can remember, as far back as I can remember, I was always performing, probably starting with wanting to make people laugh.
Okay.
So playing the clown. But then as I got older, so by the time I was 12, 13, it was more of a response to feeling angry about things. So when I didn't get a job in the co-op down the road, I Bic razored my head, sprayed it gold and walked around the shop. And unbeknownst to me, I was making live art. And the same
and also proving that you were eminently employable, really. So, you know.
I got really cross because they asked what I would do if someone spilt liquid in the store, and I said, well, I'd clean it up. And they were like, wrong answer. You would go and fetch a sign, a caution sign, and secure the area. And I don't know why, but that just made me really cross. Okay. Because it just felt lacking in common sense and bureaucratic. And the same with school. So I got quite angry at school about being bullied or picked on. I was put in a remedial educational unit. I wasn't allowed in the mainstream school and I was totally othered. So it was all kids that were about to be expelled or were neurodivergent, but they didn't call it that back then. We were just called naughty. And that made me quite cross. So I used
isn't it,
to.
Isn't it fascinating that, you know, if you say, for example, you got 30 kids, when I was at school, a long time ago, 30 kids in the class, you know, the teacher gets compliance by teaching to the collective engaged group. So that might be 20 out of the 30 because there's five that are like bored stiff because they're super intelligent, you know, and then there's five that are kind of bored stiff or appear to be bored stiff because they're actually just struggling to engage with the way that the teacher's presenting, the individual themselves, the fact that it's being written, and there's dyscalculia, dyslexia, and all these sorts of things. So what you're actually doing is out of a group of people like that, young people, you're always failing a group that are either super one end or super at the other end. You know, we now know because of ADHD and neurodivergency, actually, they're not stupid. They're actually probably cleverer than other people in the class.
Yeah, so, but you're
collectively put in this remedial unit and actually feeling like you're being punished for just being...
Well, the issue with it was I can understand why you would exclude those kids, even if that sounds controversial, because I've been on the other side and it only takes a couple of kids to totally derail a class and that's a nightmare. And, you know, if you've got kids that aren't containable in that situation, then that is a nightmare in itself. But it was more the othering because it was on the side of the mainstream school, it was like wearing a dunce's cap. So everyone knew who these kids were. So, you know, obviously it was... you know, a vehicle for being picked on. So my response to that was to wear forks in my hair, to wear plastic bags to school, to make, on one occasion, I made a massive pencil that towered above me out of papier-mâché and carried that around the school. So I was always doing these like little interventions. And then when I was about 13, 14, I did do theatre. I did mainstream theatre. And, got really depressed and started to have suicidal thoughts and stuff. And I didn't go to drama school, but I went to Leicester College, which was Charles Keane, and did the BTEC in performing arts with Dean McQueen, who founded Dance Floor, which is now called Fabric in Nottingham. And by then, because I'd been in and out of school and excluded, I think I'd managed maybe 2 days maximum a week in school. I think I left with 3 GCSEs, didn't get maths, failed art, got like a D. My art teacher was like a perv. He perved on all the girls. I used to tell him to F off and leave the classroom. So he used to like make us draw things like zips and chocolate bars. And the idea was you were supposed to draw them realistically.
So Miffy, you mentioned there about theatre and performance and stuff like that. I mean, it sounds like before you came across a structured, in inverted commas, theatre performance opportunity through education, being in school, you were already performing as a way of owning your being othered, would you say?
Yes, yeah. Before it was, well, I was an outsider artist, yeah. So I was using performance to process stuff, to make sense of the world. And this is what I'm talking about it, because it is foundational. So now it's a language, art is a language, and I use it to communicate things that probably don't make any sense to me. So even when I talk about an emotion like anger or something that is hard to express or articulate, then I can take that feeling, that emotion to the work, and art is allowed to be incoherent in a way that you're not when you're trying to write, which I struggle to do. I'm quite good with talking, but then I overtalk and I go off on tangents. So for me, the most direct form of communication I have is my practice, which now is predominantly movement based. So I don't, and sound based. So I don't have to worry about articulating through words.
Dialogue. Now I've put here, one of the things to talk to you about is you came and did a performance, if that's the correct description of it, at the High Cross when we had a pop-up shop to do with art and stuff, you know, and someone who's been on the podcast, Samantha Pebbedy, she was there as well. So it was really interesting. And you were in the shop sort of performing with like paint and footprints on paper and stuff. And then you actually went out on the mall. And I can remember, because I've got actually film of it and some photographs, and just the reaction of people, you know, going about that sort of day-to-day shopping in the High Cross, which probably is a completely different podcast, but and then here you were. Actually, I think your face was covered. Was your face covered at that time?
I was wearing a Starbucks paper bag
over your head. That was, I remember now. And just seeing people's reaction. And sometimes it's not meant to make sense to people. Mm. It's just meant to make them stop and think, well, maybe everything else is stupid. Mm. And actually what you were doing was the most intelligent practical thing.
Often in those kind of situations, I mean, there's live arts, a broad spectrum, like any art form. But I'm not trying to scare people necessarily, potentially, like you say, disconcert them. But like when someone's disconcerted, then they're maybe more aware or their perception shifts. And so they are getting something from the experience as well, just by having, you know, that moment of like, oh, hang on a minute, what is that? And it's just shifting their perception a little bit. So I think they're probably getting something from it too. But in that situation, I mean, that performance that you're talking about, it's called Lady of the Sea. And it's to do with, and I'm not sponsored by Starbucks, but it's to do with the idea that Starbucks have this...
They were just very friendly to us that day, weren't they?
They were very nice.
They looked after us. Cassius,
they
looked
did.
After us.
Yeah. The Starbucks staff were very nice, and they gave me... I didn't have any materials really to make my work with, so I scavenged around the High Cross shopping centre asking for materials for my performance. And the dress I was wearing, I found... I remember I saw you and I legged it around the corner. I said, I need a costume, John. I'll be back soon. Legged it around the corner to a charity shop, found a dress... So they gave me this dress to wear, and then I scavenged some cups and bags and stuff from various shops.
So literally, you turned up with, and this sounds really bad, nothing to wear, no materials, and no idea what you were going to do.
Basically.
But actually, everything that came from that was almost like, you know, from this just going with the flow.
It was truly site specific. So I was responding. If you're asking what it was about. I was responding to the place that I was. I was responding to the commercial environment, but I was also looking to utilise objects that were natural to that environment, that people could relate to. So the colour red, for me, you know, was just really I didn't know I was going to use red, basically. I had a Union Jack plastic bag as well, which I found on the market around the corner. So everything was just scavenged. And in the space of about an hour or two, I said, I'll be back. And I just kind of brought all this stuff back in. And
well, I was quite anxious you weren't going to come back, because when you disappeared, you're like, I'm off to scavenge. I'm assuming she's coming back. But
it's nice, because that really, it does really encapsulate my practice. That's what I do. Yeah. So, and I've been doing it since a young age. And that, so Lady of the Sea, so Starbucks play with this mermaid motif in their branding. So I was really interested in that. And then I was really interested in the idea that, like, women were often seen as bad luck at sea, and all these ideas about the siren calling and, like, you know, women being the death of things and somehow,
and
like...
And also, like, finding a woman stowed away on board was considered bad luck, wasn't it, as well?
So, oh, yes. Yeah.
So, Miffy, in your practice, I know that, as well as your own sort of practice, if you like, you are working with and encouraging and supporting sort of, you know, community arts, and working with students that are studying fine art in, you know, at various places and stuff. How do you think you are perceived by these sort of students who, you know, got their own version of their own creativity, and I've turned up and I'm here, and maybe they've got this sort of usual view of what a tutor's going to be? Particularly, I think a lot of artists that Rob and I have spoken to on the podcast are, like, you know, very affected by, like, hey, let's draw this fruit. Or you mentioned that teacher, let's draw a zip, you know. And then they come across you. You know, what do you think people think of you when they come across you?
Well, I hate to go back to the neurodivergence thing, but I've got terrible anxiety issues. And generally, I think...
Do they recognise themselves in you, do you think? As in, like,
I don't know, because this is when I'm really not perceptive. In terms of how other people see me, I have no idea. I genuinely just assume people don't like me. I'm not trying to make people feel so...
Is that your default position?
Yeah. I just think I'm, you know... But I do accept that that's to do... Social anxiety is part of, you know, having, like, behavioural disorder or whatever they've called it now. But I think that I challenge the people I work with, and that's probably why I'm going to this... talking about whether they like me or not. So it's not necessarily that they like me, but then to an extent, like, you want to be challenged in your practice. So I've never, with the students, like, I've just unofficially, like, gathered them. So it's not at all official. It's
And is that because you think, from your experience and what you've seen, that structured education, or that system, if you want, or for teaching people, isn't necessarily the best way for either you to be corralled or pigeonholed, but also that for the students that you are naturally drawn to, you, they are looking for that alternative.
Oh, you know, without sounding too dramatic, John, I would say I think I've got institutional trauma. Yeah. And I think that people who feel the same or have been traumatized by institutions will gravitate towards me. And then that my lack of organisation, which you've experienced directly, is challenging for people. But actually, that becomes a trust exercise. So anyone I collaborate with, I'm actually setting up a situation of vulnerability and trust, which is totally, you know, an antithesis, if you like, to an institutional environment, I would say.
So almost like after 3 or 4 minutes with you, people feel that they're not in a safe space because you've had to tell them, you create this safe space around you for them to be themselves, and so you kind of draw out from them who they are. Because sometimes people are expecting you to say, hey, it's safe, I'm a safe person, we're about to do something that's safe, be yourself. And straight away I'd be like, well, actually, why would you say that? Because are you waiting for me to do something then?
Yeah.
Whereas I think from the first time that I met you, and the reason that I gravitated to talking to you, and why we still know each other, and why you're here on the podcast and doing all the things we're going to be doing, is the fact that it's the fact that you bring this alternative way of doing things. I think people need to speak to you. Even if they feel they need structure, what they actually need is someone who's going to give them the opportunity to be who they are.
I mean, I'm not anti-structure, because that would be ridiculous. I mean, how could you be? But it's almost like just making your own structure that suits you, isn't it? So, and also, you know, like any artist, after they've been doing it a while, will say your structure becomes so integral to what you're doing that you probably don't even notice it anyway. So I've got lots of methodologies and lots of structures, but in terms of collaboration, you know, I'm not about telling people what to do. or having the answers. And so things do take an open-ended improvisational approach.
So you're drawing it out of people?
Yeah, well, because I've started curating other people, because I got really upset at the start of the year and I was being curated and stuff, and I fell out with loads of people again, like I do for various reasons. Probably a lot of them quite petty. But because of my behavioural kind of disorder side of... So I've got like learning disabilities, coordination disabilities and behavioural kind of side of it. So I can get really over-emotional and like really hurt by something that someone else would think is, you know, like heartbroken, something that can break my heart, you know. So I had that kind of experience with some of the people I'd been curated by at the start of the year and stuff. And art is so up and down anyway. And then you can get all excited and your ego can get all inflated. You're like, yes, I'm getting somewhere now. I'm making it. Something's going to happen. Then obviously it all just explodes. and then you're like, anyway, and you're like, well, what was all that about anyway? And that was weird. And it's not even what I wanted to do. So I thought, no, I'm just going to curate other people, like whose work that I like. And then, so you're working with, like maybe 19, 20, 21, 22, 23 year olds. And as you know, that's like a totally different experience to working with older artists. And this wasn't even community art like how it was before, because it wasn't even going out into communities. It was like what you're saying, making a new community, right? And so then, but then bringing in some older artists, and they're the difficult ones to work with, because they'll come into your situation. They'll be like, so what's the plan? Like you were saying, or, you know, what's happening, and almost like pulling faces at you, like you don't know what you're doing, and then there's an element of like where I might feel a bit cheeky, and then it becomes a bit of a provocation as well, and a bit of a wind up, because you're like, well, we said we'd start at 7, but it doesn't feel like the right time yet. And I just have to say this like quickly. So we did this group show at Two Queens. What did we call it? Called it the Masking Show. So I decided that this year I was going to unmask and I wasn't going to hide my neurodivergence. This was going to be like, you know, no masking. So we did a masking show and I think the audience turned up at 6:30. I did the running order round about then, and everyone was just kind of there on the sidelines, and I just dumped a load of stuff in the space, as you've seen me do. There was a road cone, a tyre, some other bits and bobs. Oh, a rope. Oh, actually, I took this woman out with a rope, but that's another story, accidentally. She was a lecturer at De Montfort, and I ended up whacking her with this rope.
I'm sure she could handle it. So you're listening to John Costa with Rob Watson on the Spotlight on Art show this week. So, Rob, it's interesting listening to Miffy talking about her practice, but also sort of spaces and stuff like that. I'm hearing her talk about, you know, providing these spaces for people to be what they're interested in and stuff. And I'm really thinking about our conversation earlier about community media and how everybody thinks, oh, radio, television, newspapers, what's new, social media, trying to fit in, rather than thinking, well, what am I interested in, or what am I good at, and what do I care for, what do I want to talk about? They almost think like they've got to do it in a particular way because of the structure, whereas in fact what we're looking for is people to say, well, actually, I'm interested in this and I've got some skills.
There's, I mean, it's great listening to how you describe and the way that you work, and the what you witness from other people's responses to it is that we're living in a period where people are dominated by thinking, planning, as you say, what's the plan? We need to know what the outcome's going to be. And it's like, well, this is more what you describe, and what I'm picking up on is that it's more feelings driven. And to almost to a degree where you can't contain those feelings, because they come up and take over, if you like, and then they go back because you've expressed them. And that kind of is that intuitive, emergent kind of model. It's a performance, it's part of that. We don't have enough spaces for that. And so an awful lot of people struggle because the dominant approach is systems and logic. The way that we understand things and the way that we perceive things isn't just about, if you like, a set of coherent, structured ideas. We have to go out and experience things, and we have to reflect and understand what those experiences are. And that isn't just on a kind of, you can look at things logically, but that only tells you part of the story. And you have to, you know, what's driving the experiences. And if art creates that kind of space, but I think, you know, our art culture has become the antithesis of that. It's become these controlled spaces where everything's kind of driven by, you know,
driven by outcome and plan. Like,
yeah, and the lecture on the you know, the essay that you have to read on the wall to understand what the work's about. You know, it's
two things. I mean, outcome and structure is to do with funding often, because, you know, that's the other thing. So this year I decided to not mask anymore, and I decided to abandon all hope of ever being funded and to just sack all that off. So, and I'm much happier for it. So
Rob and I have had this conversation many times.
It's just like, yeah. So, I mean, if I work with anyone, the expectation is basically like, I have no money. You have no money. We're not going to make any money.
Let's be creative.
Let's just be creative, which was inspired actually the next show I curated after the masking show, which was Skint Joy. So I did a Skint Joy austerity cabaret. And that was just about, well, how do you have fun if you've got no money? It was basically just simple, and we did. But the other thing, so there's funding, and then I've lost the thread now. What did you say? Funding and plans and...
Yeah, plans and outcomes. And it's outcomes. Like you've got a hypothesis that you kind of told that you need to know. You're exploring something.
Oh, yes, that you like research. Like it's like almost like it's like art has to be like science, like it's research or something. So the writing on the wall. Yes, all the writing on the wall. So I don't, like I said, telling about my issue with reading and writing, and yeah, that really gets in the way. So, but then people can get angry the other way if there's no explanation, like you say, and then they can think you're being pretentious as well. Like, you're not explaining this and I don't understand what it's about. But I would go back to what I said before about what I wanted to do when I was a kid, which was to make people laugh. So even with my anger, if I'm feeling angry, I almost want to make that into a funny experience for other people. And I really enjoy creating situations where people are laughing. So when I talk about like the emotional response that I would often ask for from my work or work that I've curated, which was why the Skint Joy thing was important, I want to make people happy actually. And I want people to actually have a laugh. And that's what drives like the presentation anyway of anything I do. So even if people feel uncomfortable or disconcerted, I'm not about scaring people or upsetting people actually. I want them to have a bit, a reprieve from all of that. And that's, so no reading, no studying, no plans, no outcomes, but a bit of a laugh, yeah.
I'm kind of challenging you to have and use your time in a different way other than just consuming Netflix. I'm actually saying to you, come out to some live art where actually the title may or may not reflect what's going to happen. Mm. There is or there isn't a program. Suddenly this, you know, pile of stuff that appears in the middle, and then whatever comes from that, you are truly in a two-way interactive something that's about to happen.
Well, at Skint Joy, when we didn't really know what was going to happen, but one of the performers that I work with quite often, who is a really interesting live artist called Alison Wallacott. She lives a bit further north over the way. You will meet her because she's going to work with us a bit. She all she knew was that she wanted to put Tilly in a box. Tilly was one of the fine art students. And Tilly is another really interesting artist, Leicester based, and she spent a year living as a chicken. So she wanted to put Tilly in the box. So she put Tilly in the box, and then somehow, and I don't know how it happened, this packet of salt, ready salted crisps appeared from somewhere. So Tilly just somersaulted out of this box and started wandering around the audience. And all she said, she just approached every person and she just said, ready salted? And then she'd move on to the next person and she'd say, ready salted? And it was so surreal, so unexpected. I didn't know this was going to happen. I don't think anyone did. It was just, but it was... it was funny, you know, it was comical. She was in a bra and pants wearing this chicken hood thing that she'd made, offering everyone just one ready salted crisp. And most people did. And then it was like communion as well. And then it's almost like religious, yeah? And everyone took one.
So Mithy, we're going to be collaborating soon on my Doc Space exhibition that I've got here for 3 weeks. And you've got... part of your community group, that a couple of these artists that you've drawn to yourself are going to be here as well. What kind of things do you how do you explain it to them, what people are going to do? I don't mean about me or what it's called, but it's like, you know, how do you explain an opportunity to someone like that to come and be involved in an exhibition?
Well, I have to go back to emotions, because actually a lot of people say the way I curate would do their heads in. So the way I curate, I pretty much don't know up till maybe even an hour before who's in or who's out. Like, yeah, who's coming? Yeah. Is this going to happen? And a lot of people are like, that would really... So I don't ask for like... I mean, with this, it's slightly different because it's object-based. Obviously, we're talking about photos. So in a way, the work's already there. So it's more just about then seeking active consent. And that gets emotional too, because there's always this assumption that you want to show your work, you know, you've made this work. Surely you want to show it and you want people to see it. Well, I spent a long time performing in places where there was no audience. And I totally get that you might just not want to show it. So I've got a really talented photographer I collaborate with called Nick Thorne, who was initially like really enthusiastic, and he takes beautiful images. And now he's gone quiet, and I don't know if he's okay, what's happening at the minute. And you know this yourself with working with people, because emotions do get involved. So Nick, I'm not sure about at the moment, but Alison. But then I realised when we were talking about photography, and then I said to you that I wanted to look at people who photograph live art, and that's like, because that's another aspect of live art. How do people see it if they haven't seen it live? So then I thought, well, this is about couples though. It's a relationship between two people, the photographer and the subject. And then I thought, well, this could be quite an intimate thing. So I asked Alison if she wanted to show documentation of her performance, because her daughter photographs her, Frankie Woollycott, who again is I haven't spoken to you about her, she's a really talented photographer, and she's younger as well. So I thought, well, that could be like a really nice intimate like coupling, like their relationship drawn out through that work. And then I spoke to you about Richard Johnson, and he's my partner, and he photographs my live art practice. And again, obviously that's an intimate relationship, and he's not ever exhibited his work, and he's only ever credited as anonymous in my work and hasn't got any social media presence. So these people kind of really tick this box of like making work, but not necessarily wanting to show it. So that's the curatorial line I'm navigating in this collaboration. I'm trying to kind of encourage people who don't necessarily want to show this work to kind of show it in this context. So it's emotional again, and it's a vulnerability. So right now, you know, it's two, maybe three photographers, you know,
it.
And that's
I love it.
That's all I can say.
I only wish that was live streamed, because you did this kind of like balance scale part like airs like this. Yeah. I think also what I find quite interesting about what you're just saying there is it's not this sort of practitioner, performer, audience, a receptor of what's going on here. We're almost looking at it from the point of view that as a performer, who actually helps you, who's key to your practice as much as not, you know, when you're younger, it's invariably a parent driving you somewhere. You know, anybody wins a gold medal, it was like, you know, mum and dad drove me to the swimming pool every morning for 7 years at 6 o'clock. You know, so someone, whenever you see the person in front of you, there's always this group.
I still can't swim.
Bear with me, I'm going down a rabbit hole. There's always this kind of group of people that enable you to be what you do. You know, and it sounds like what you're saying there is this, you know, mother, daughter, you and your partner is this symbiotic relationship between, there's always someone that can help you or support you. It's how do you find them, I guess, isn't it?
Yeah. And also, this is also celebrating, if you like, the mechanics behind something a bit, isn't it? So, it's kind of celebrating those people, like you say, that are helping making it happen, maybe more in the background. And so it's a thank you as well. Yeah, it's a gesture, isn't it? It's like, yeah. Well, look, you know, you should have your moment now, which is what really enthused me about it. And we're talking about some really interesting, beautiful images as well, you know, because they're like world building images. I mean, even what you're talking about, what I did in the High Cross that you documented, in a way, it was creating this alternate reality, which is something that I've become more conscious of. That's what I'm doing. I'm creating alternate realities. And yeah.
So Miffy, I want to talk to you about now about that. Imagine you were 14, 15, again, being that sort of young person at school with your big paper mache pen, being othered by everybody else because of the building that you went into. Or maybe when you were slightly older, like, you know, 19, 20 now, with the age group of that you're working with, this little community of artists you've created. Do you think if that was you now with social media, life would be easier or harder for you?
Well, I nearly invented YouTube with a friend, but we got really drunk and totally missed Saatchi, who came round to look at our work. So this is like my tragic story of like, I could have made it, but we invented something called RTV. and it was before YouTube existed. So I was 19, 20 at the time. And it's not dissimilar to like some of the practice you do. So we followed the Met police around for a couple of weeks, like just harassing them, interviewing them, asking them who they worked for, filming the May Day riots, getting caught up in various anti-capitalist maneuvers. And called it RTV and were like just kind of rolling it. So this was like the kind of the first wave of digital cameras. So we had them, then they were still quite bulky.
Never knew that. That's amazing. That's a great, I mean, that's a completely different podcast, but there we go.
And then we got really drunk the night before and our room kept getting sabotaged because like the other fine arts students really objected to our work. They found it very gauche and very plebeian and common or whatever. And we had like smoke machine and flashing lights and someone kept smashing this light. And so we locked the room, went and got really drunk and totally missed. I went to Goldsmiths. Charles Saatchi always does a walk round, so the show gets put up. Everything's really like particular, including the grey that the floor is painted with. Goldsmiths have this grey specially mixed, so everything is like off, just nuts. Siemens mobile phone company sponsored the show before they cut it because they decided, okay, this isn't very PC. So there was just like rivers of wine and it was just decadent. Channel 4 were like in desperate to get in and film what was going on. They weren't allowed to. It was just bizarre. And anyway, so we locked the room.
That's a parallel universe you're describing.
It was awful. I hated it. Actually, I really hated it. We locked the room, went and got really drunk and Charles Saatchi couldn't get in the room to see our work. And, you know, and I knew people, you know, he'd gone and I was really gutted at the time. I was like, oh, I think if he'd seen my work, I know he would have really liked it. But now I don't know if I regret it. I think it's all right. Yeah.
The one that got away.
So if social media had existed then, I would have loved it. I love it anyway, because I read about people saying that it's superficial or, oh, you know, it's you're just curating yourself or you're, you know, trying to get attention. But I love it. It's like I've instantly got an audience. I can just go and do a performance and I can show people it. I love it.
And so really as a performer, in its broadest sense, you're talking about being able to find your audience
that's
an audience for what you do that doesn't have to be place-based or a geographic audience. You can reach out to your tribe, if you like, that's elsewhere, isn't it? People that like live art.
Well, I'm from the generation, you know, when you had the cassette tapes and, you know, you recorded bits off the radio, like tunes you liked, and then you made up your own radio show. And, you know, and that's what you did. And you had these little, like, mixtapes with yourself talking or your friends talking and tunes mixed in. And that's what we did. But, gosh, yeah, YouTube, I'd be all over it. I would just... I just don't think young people embrace it enough. Like, they are... It's almost like it makes them more self-conscious, doesn't it? And like you say, they have to, like, present this version of themselves. But I think as a, like, creative tool, I think it's... I've fallen out with so many artists about it because a lot of artists really hate it. And I had a really big fallout about social media because I put some artwork prices up on an Instagram post. And it was art that had been made with, like, well, rubbish, basically, reclaimed materials. That's not to say it didn't have value. But I put the prices up without thinking and it really upset some of these other artists. Like, how dare you do that? But I'm just really open with, you know, with my practice in a way that a lot of artists... Because I don't make stuff to sell, that's why. So for me, and even if it does have monetary value, I think, well, everything gets nicked anyway. So what's the point in even worrying about it? So I just feel like that about it. Like, but that's just me. And then I have to respect that not everyone feels the same. And
that's, but that's the great thing about it. I think you're willing to be you. You're willing to articulate what you think. And that's why I'm looking forward to you curating the part of Doc Space that opens on the 29th of September here in the Basement Gallery at Adult Ed, and then seeing where it goes forward. And we're certainly going to be here throughout those 3 weeks doing some podcasts. So hopefully we'll be joined by you again and some of your artists as well. So thanks very much for talking to us.
Thank you, and really nice to meet you again.